This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest needs no introduction to public radio listeners, but I won't let that stop me from reminding you of the crucial role she's played in the development of public radio and the progress of women in media. In 1972, when she became co-host of All Things Considered, Susan Stamberg also became the very first woman to anchor a daily national news program. All Things Considered broadened the definition of news, and Susan added a new dimension to the role of anchor. She sounded respectful, yet informal, whether she was talking to a head of state or her favorite novelist. There was often a surprising intimacy in her conversations. The force of her on-air personality helped put NPR on the map. Since leaving All Things Considered in 1986, she's hosted Sunday Weekend Edition and been a special correspondent for NPR. She returns to guest hosting Saturday Weekend Edition in July. Susan has a new book called Talk, which features excerpts of 20 years of interviews and her reflections on her work. I wondered what it was like for her to listen back to her early interviews. Had her voice changed over the years?
I was so formal. And in those early days, when there weren't a whole lot of women on the air, in fact, none doing news, I was the first to anchor a nightly national news program, 1972, with All Things Considered. We were imitating men, so I was lowering my voice to sound as authoritative as I could. And I hear in those tapes my getting looser and more relaxed with it. I hear in more recent work speeding up to a point where it's almost too fast sometime. I've got to start slowing myself down again. I hear those changes in voice per se, but also, a growth of confidence, which I hope happens to you. I used to feel about radio, you keep doing it until you get it right. You know, you practice it every day and someday it'll kick in. And I hope that that happens too over the years.
Let's go back to, was it 1972 when you started hosting All Things Considered?
Yeah.
Okay, now the first time you hosted, it was a substitute.
Yes, I sat in.
Who were you filling in for?
I have to say, Terry, there's a lot of first women and feminist stuff in this book because I'm a believer in it. But men gave me breaks every inch of the way. And he wasn't the first host of All Things Considered. That was a man named Robert Conley. But he was the second one, I think, Mike Waters. Was doing the program, and at that point, I was hired as a tape editor, but at that point, because things were so open and possible at NPR in those days, I was also getting stuff on the air. He said to me, "I really like your work. How can we hear you more? I'm going on vacation. Why don't you sit in?" And it was that kind of generosity. He went away. I sat there. There was nice response to it, and poof, we were co-hosts.
As the first woman to anchor a national daily news show, were there complaints that the network got from either listeners or stations that carried the show?
There were. But you know something, Terry? I didn't know about it. I write about this in Talk, too. This is a story that I heard 11 years after the fact, and I heard it from Bill Siemring, who was important in getting you on the air. I know that when he was a manager of the station.
Absolutely. We would never have become a national show if it weren't for Bill Siemring.
We wouldn't exist, All Things Considered, NPR, if it hadn't been for Bill Siemring. That's exactly right. He was our first, I think they called him program director then, and the man who really conceived of All Things Considered. And he told me this story 11 years later, that when I first went on the air, there was quite a bit of opposition, not from listeners, but from the managers of our stations who were worried on behalf of the listeners. A woman's voice is not authoritative enough, they said. Women will not be taken seriously. A woman cannot do news. Now, maybe in those days, there was one little piece of it that could have been correct, and it was about the voice carrying. Technologically, we were not nearly as sophisticated as we are today. We had bad, staticky telephone lines over which we broadcast to the country. Today, we've got satellites, so things are clearer. And the bass band of women's voices is not as strong as it is in the voices of men. And so maybe my voice didn't carry quite as well as it would today, but that was about it. The rest of it was prejudice. Anyway, Bill never said a word to me. And this, to me, was such a remarkable show of the quality of his leadership. He knew if he told me. I was very sensitive about it all. I was nervous as heck. And it would affect me. It would throw me in some way. It would affect my work. And he had enough confidence in me to let me keep going, sensing that I would prove myself as I did it, and the criticism would go away. And it did.
So if you hadn't been protected from these comments, you think you would have been more insecure than angry?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, it would have been a mixture of both. But I sure brought heavy bags of insecurity along with me and very nervous and concerned. It was such an important thing to me. I mean, it was this network. It was starting. I'd done radio for some years, but I wasn't speaking to the country. I was speaking locally here on a Washington public radio station. So this, you know, it was a dream of those of us in public broadcasting for years, that there'd be this interconnection. We could talk to the nation. And here I was the one doing the talking. So, there was a lot. There was a lot of it.
Did anyone tell you that you sounded too New York?
Oh, sure.
Did anyone ever say you sounded too Jewish?
Sure, yeah. No, they don't say Jewish. They say New York, and I always hear that as Jewish and maybe more than a little anti-Semitic. I certainly didn't and don't sound like people who are on the radio today. I really don't. I have a distinctive sound. And it is, you're right, I'm a New Yorker and I'm Jewish. There's nothing to be ashamed of in either of those. They're simply facts of life, and people have commented on it. Yeah, sure.
Your style, I think, is one that is very direct, very casual, very real. And that wasn't really the style when you started broadcasting. And as you said before, you were really trying to kind of put on this air of authoritative and sound like more male.
Isn't that funny?
to fit in, how did you start drifting away from that and becoming more of who you were?
Well, I in those days, in addition to doing all the broadcasting and most of the interviews, we had five reporters, so the hosts really did a tremendous amount on the program every day. I was also editing my own tapes. I mean, we had these skinny little skeletal staffs, so you had to do everything. And I think it was in editing my own work really taught me a lot. It taught me to hate that stiff sound that I was trying so hard to produce, to say I could hear how phony it was, and I just decided to stop.
Can you share with us one of the scary moments from an early broadcast of All Things Considered when the staff was small and the show was still being defined?
Oh, you bet. We had those every other day. The tape would keep breaking, or the tape wouldn't arrive in the control room on time. I can remember a very early program in which I introduced something. The tape went on the air, and the director, Rich Firestone, said in my head, said, wait a minute, the tape's on backwards. Phil, and threw my microphone on, and I talked. He got the tape, he turned it around, he ran it again, and he said in my ear, wrong, it's Russian. Phil again. It wasn't backward. It was a foreign language. And he put my microphone on, and I got to talk some more. I would come in those days, Terry, with reams of clippings and papers and books to use as film material, because I always knew something was going to go wrong. You know, I still do that, actually, tell you the truth. When I substitute for Mr. Edwards on Morning Edition or go in to do the Weekend Edition Saturday program live, I'll always take a little something with me, because you never know.
You hosted All Things Considered for, I think it was 14 years?
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Oh, I left for a range of reasons. I've been wanting to get off that program for quite some time. It is an enormous grind. Noah Adams and I were wonderful partners on the air for 5 years, and the only thing, and we are dear friends, the only thing we ever fought about was who had the harder job in broadcasting, whether he did or I did. Since we had exactly the same job, we had a good time fighting over for whom it was harder. I suppose it was for me, because I did it for so much longer than anybody else did. And that just was a lot of it. There was a tremendous kind of revolving door in the staff, and that takes its toll on you. You know, people sort of moving through and needing to be trained up and needing to be taught radio and taught what it was we were doing. That can burn you out pretty quickly. I don't feel I ever burned out, but it was a conscious decision that I really wanted to get off that daily carousel, something that I wanted to do for some time. I write in this book really made the decision final was the fact that in 1986 I discovered I had breast cancer. It was treated. My prognosis is excellent. But that was the point at which I said to myself, okay, this is something you've wanted for a long time. Now's the time to do it. You don't need this kind of stress in your life. I take my work very, very personally, and I work awfully, awfully hard. And it doesn't come easily to me. And I just wanted to move that quotient of stress out of my life and do less. And I did.
How many people did you tell about the breast cancer?
Very few. I told family, of course, and a handful of really close friends, and only a few people, here at NPR who I felt needed to know.
Did you go through chemo? And
no, I had a lumpectomy and radiation.
And you'd come to work after the radiation?
Yeah, I was working all through that and doing a piece which I adore, actually. It was a salvation through that time. I felt I needed to keep working. Work has been important to me at a lot of rough times in my life, as it is for many of us, I think. It was a piece about Beryl Markham. I had been the year earlier over to Kenya with a team from All Things Considered covering the UN Decade of Women's Conference, and read on the plane on the way over this extraordinary book, West with the Night. She was just this extraordinary British woman who went over there. Her father was a Kenya pioneer, settled, became the first woman to cross the Atlantic Ocean the other way. I think she flew from London to Nova Scotia or something, solo piloting a horsewoman, horse breeder. And Peter Breslow and I worked on that piece all through the radiation. Beryl Markham saved my life, I think. She kept me going through that.
There must have been times when... after radiation treatment, if you'd go to the NPR offices, you'd really feel like saying to everybody, listen, you don't know what I've been through this morning.
No, I don't. That's not me.
Mm-hmm.
Long pause. The most compelling thing you can do on the radio. Keep quiet.
So you didn't?
No,
people did not need to know.
No, I didn't. I wasn't ready to do that to people. And I wasn't ready to handle their reactions to it. I'm a bucker-upper. It's part of my nature. I like to make people feel better. I'm the one that, in the All Things Considered days, when the program was being put marked up on a big map on the wall, I'd come in. That would start at 2:30, the order of the pieces and who was going to be reporting what. I was the one that would come up to that map and say, where is the joy in this radio program? And I did what I could to be the bringer of joy whenever I could to the air. And I felt that I didn't want to inflict this on people. And I also selfishly didn't want to have to cheer them up or make them feel better, which is a part of what illness, what happens with illness. People become very upset with you, and I feel a certain obligation.
So this was in 1986?
Yeah, 86.
Did you need something that drastic in order to give yourself permission to leave All Things Considered?
Well, I certainly hope not. I hope I would take better care of myself than that. This has been a long time in coming. We had many years of talk about it. I really was ready to get off the program and to move on. I've had some regrets from time to time. There's a kind of access that kind of daily broadcasting gives you.
The hosting All Things Considered must have been a very difficult position to walk out on, even though you felt like you really needed to do it. Because, I mean, you knew the impact you were having on people's lives.
It was very clear in my mind. Yes, I didn't like breaking that contract with listeners. It's a very important one to me, and it's something that I feel defines what a host is. They expect you to be there all the time. And so it troubled me, and I got some wonderful mail in the aftermath of that, and people who still tell me that they miss me from it. But I was going on to a wonderful new challenge, which was putting Weekend Edition Sunday on the air, and there was that to look forward to, getting moving something new on, and it meant doing it once a week, and that I welcomed enormously.
Are there things that you reclaimed from your personal life after you left A Daily Show?
Yes, sloppiness was one, and
Great.
Yeah, it was wonderful too. I just felt I had to was always so super organized. You really have to do that and be that way in order to get the daily journalism done, as well as the family and all those other obligations. So I could just loosen up a whole lot in my life, and I think that was the greatest benefit to me. Really was.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you recognize my guest voice. My guest is Susan Stamberg, and she's just put together a new book called Talk. NPR's Susan Stamberg considers all things. It includes excerpts of her interviews from the past 20 years and a lot of behind-the-scenes stories about how she did those interviews and her memories of the people who she's spoken to. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Susan Stamberg is my guest, author of the new book, Talk. Susan, there's something I want to ask you, and this relates to breast cancer, but it's much more about interviewing. When Like, I sense that the breast cancer is not something you're really interested in talking about in detail. The question always comes up for me, as I'm sure it does for you, how far do you go with somebody when there's something personal that's happened in your life that you'd maybe like to hear more about, but you have a feeling they probably don't want to talk about it more? Now, what's your general... How do you guide yourself when asking that question?
Well, I don't have a rule of thumb, but it happens often in this book. I see evidence of it. And I see an interesting development as well. A rule with me, and I think it's a current one too, is if someone starts crying, I turn off the tape recorder. It's why I wasn't meant to do journalism. I have all the wrong instincts. If it's that painful... they need to be private about it, and I don't need to record that, to broadcast that pain to others. If they can talk about it, it's one thing. I just hate when on television the camera zooms in and focuses, you know, the lens zooms in to show you the tears. It's none of my business. I turn away. But I've also, something else that I learned in going through these 20 years of material for this book is that people over these years, I've discovered that interviewing has become easier. Not just because I've done it more, but people have seen it more and heard it more. I can remember in the early days, holding a microphone out under somebody's nose, which I still think is kind of a rude gesture when I'm on the road, and having people back up and laugh self-consciously and say, oh, I don't know, you want to record that. That doesn't happen now. They're used to it. There's so much of it that's happened in these 20 intervening years that they know how to talk into microphones. They know how to be on television, and they know how to summon their strength in order to tell difficult things. I think I've also learned a lot about human resilience, and it's been something that's meant a great deal to me personally. I write that one of the things that cancer did was to affect my work and make me much more interested in people who faced up to something terrible and gone on with their lives. You don't understand what learning from someone's courage is until you need those lessons.
Susan, I know on those occasions when I'm interviewed, there are two parts of me that kind of go to war each time I'm asked a question. And one part of me is the professional part that's saying, well, as an interviewer, I ask people questions all the time, and I expect that they'll kind of reveal as much as they can and blah, blah, blah. And so I, too, should reveal as much as I can to the person answering these questions. And besides, I know that if you don't reveal a lot, you stand the risk of being really boring and there's no greater sin and so on and so on. Then the other part of me is saying, you really don't need to be very personal, and it's probably better if you're not. Because particularly as an interviewer, you need to be a kind of neutral person. Do you know what I mean?
And I do know what you mean.
And not have you want to keep people guessing in a way, and you want to be able to draw on the parts of yourself that are most relevant to the interview that you're doing and so on. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to reveal too much. So these two parts of me go to war. Is there a war like that happens to you when you're interviewed? And do you know how much you're comfortable with in revealing about yourself, whether it's your health or you know, any other personal part of your life?
Yeah, I guess so. It's not so much a war as it's not a war I fight anymore. I know what I will and what I won't speak about, and you hear the long pauses. So I know how to do that now. And getting older makes that easier. You know, Terry, my generation, we were raised as nice girls. Philip Roth says this wonderfully, too, and there somebody sends him an angry letter and asks him for lunch, and he goes. And I said to him, how come you went? Why did you do that? He said, I was young. When summoned, I went. Now, he wasn't raised as a nice girl, but I was. You're asked a question, you answer it. I don't leap to those answers quite as quickly now. Maybe I've learned a kind of privacy and a professionalism. And I also wonder, as I said, this sort of cult of personality has a short string as far as I'm concerned. There are other things to talk about. There are issues, there are ideas, there's wonderful writing to talk about.
I'll give you an example of something just that happened to me. I was interviewing Isabel Allende, the Chilean writer now living in the States. And during the interview, she'd mentioned that her daughter had died not too long. No, I knew her daughter had died, but it turned out her daughter had died in December, just a few months ago. And I could just tell by the way she just, you know, said that parenthetically, that this was something that was still obviously really close to the surface for her. And then so I had to decide, well, should I ask her more about it or should I just kind of change the subject
what
and move on?
What did you do?
I changed the subject and moved on. I just felt like, do I need to put her through this because she's written a new book? And I decided no. But in all honesty, on another day, I might have said, well, let me ask her something and maybe then I'll pull back. Do you know what I mean?
I guess
it's a really, I think, difficult question.
It's a tough call. It's a tough call. But when you know the experience is very raw, you need to, I feel the need to let people heal from it before I go poking around in those depths of their lives. And I don't know what's to be served, really. I don't know what good it does to do it. And I don't want to make my living off the pain of someone else.
Have you ever wanted to stop interviewing?
It's real nice to take breaks. It was good to take the year off to write Talk. But I never want to stop asking questions. That's the real issue. It's not so much the interviewing. I feel I am blessed that I found microphones in this world because I spend my life talking to people away from the microphone. It's something that I do naturally as a person. I'm the one on the elevator who'll turn to somebody else and say, well, did you ever think that it would get as hot as it did this early in the year? You know, I'll just sort of do that.
But you know, in the elevator, people sometimes think you're a psychopath.
Yes, they do,
a professional
but
interviewer.
I smile nicely at them and I reassure them that I'm not. But it's what I do. I'm always asking questions. I'm always curious. I'm always wanting to know. And luckily enough, I found a place where they'll pay me to do that. So, no, I can't imagine.
So what's the fantasy? If you did stop doing interviewing one day, what would it be that you wanted to do instead?
Oh, I would just want to be a jazz singer so bad, sitting in a red strapless dress with a slit in the skirt on top of a piano in some smoky bar. Can I sing? Is that your follow-up? Is your follow-up question, can you sing, Susan?
Listen, do I want to stop you? Absolutely. Go ahead.
No.
No, okay.
But I could learn.
Susan, it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, Terry.
Thanks so
always.
Much.
Always. Thank you.
Susan Stamberg's new book is called Talk. She returns to Saturday Weekend Edition in July. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.